there's going to be days where you feel like crap about yourself. And I think the more we can just reduce the stigma around that, the more receptive people will be to acknowledging that not only as part of their life, but taking the proper steps to know that they're not a failure because they're feeling that way and they'll actually make the right decision to move forward.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 71 of the Mad Happy Podcast. Today, we are joined by Doug Bobst, who is an award-winning author, fitness coach. Doug has an amazing mental health story that's really all about personal transformation. I think he spoke about really being insecure about his weight as a kid, and he turned that into being a world-renowned fitness coach, struggling with drugs and addiction, and now he's been sober for some years, and was really great for us to connect on that. It was just a really cool story about how we can turn our lives around and how change is such a big part of our lives that we often run away from for so long, but he really faced it head on and is an ex-addict and an ex-felon who now lives such an amazing life of recovery and really sticks to it. I think as someone who's, you know, walking that road every day and really hard to kind of stay on track, it was really refreshing to hear from him about how he's been able to maintain that change. I think since that's been one of the biggest things that I suffer with. And then also, I think it's just a great reminder for a lot of people, you know, what started as just being a pothead in high school for him, like, ended up having him serve a few months in jail. So I think it really was a good reminder for me of like how, you know, you never think that you can get there when you're starting out, but, you know, they call it, you know, gateway and a slippery slope for a reason. So it was really great to hear his story, and he shares it on several big podcasts that he's been on, and he has an amazing show of his own. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy the episode. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the show with Doug Bobst. Well, thanks again for coming on. I was like personally so excited to talk to you just because I can relate to a lot of your story. A fellow addict, have really struggled with mental health issues my whole life. I it's funny timing too, because I'm in this like weird place with my recovery where like I've gotten sober from drugs and alcohol for 4 years, but I have these other kind of vices with like sex and love and food and like other addictions that I still struggle with that have been a lot harder for me to figure out and stay off my bottom lines. I actually just got a sponsor last week for the first time.
Let's go.
Yeah, so moving forward, like you said, but definitely good timing for me and just great timing for our audience and everyone to hear your story. So thanks for coming on, Doug.
Dude, it's a pleasure, man. Thanks for having me. I'm honored.
Oh, of course. We always like to start at the beginning. So we'd just love to hear a bit about like your upbringing in Baltimore, what your childhood was like, and sort of that environment.
Yeah, man. I mean, I tell this a lot because it's kind of ironic. I host a podcast today called The Adversity Advantage. And the reason I host the podcast is to help people get through hard times and not make challenging times worse based on how they respond to those hard times. And I say that because I was on the opposite end of that spectrum to where I used adversity to my complete disadvantage. And some of the adversity in my life growing up was like I said, I was born and raised in Baltimore, never have left here. My parents got divorced when I was 5. And so I'm going to be 35 here in a few weeks. And back then when I was 5, almost, you know, 30 years ago, like kids' families weren't really being broken apart as much as they are today. So at a young age, I'm starting to ask myself, like, what's wrong with me? Why is my situation different than other kids whose parents were still together? And I would go over to their house and their parents would be there. And I'd be like, why am I like spending time here certain days of the week? Then I got to go here, and then I got to go here and here. And then on top of that, my parents were fighting and it was a pretty rough divorce. And I say that because as I look back, I think that was just the beginning of the downfall for me and how I developed this mentality of like, what's wrong with me and why am I so different? Mm-hmm. And I know you like to talk about mental health and that sort of thing on the podcast. So I'll kind of talk about how my childhood evolved with that narrative. And so the divorce happens. I start to ask myself, like, why am I different? On top of that, as I was beginning to get a little bit older, I loved sports. I loved playing sports. I loved watching sports, like collecting sports cards. I'm dating myself when I say this, but I would stay up late to watch SportsCenter. I'd get up early to watch SportsCenter. And The problem, though, was I wasn't good at sports. And so my hopes and dreams of not necessarily being a professional athlete, but my hopes and dreams at the time of making certain sports teams, fitting in with the crowd, hopefully eventually maybe one day playing a sport in high school, all these things were kind of shattered for me at that time in my life because I wasn't making the teams. I noticed that I was more uncoordinated than my friends, less athletic, kind of was the kid who was always being picked last for these sporting events. And again, it started to stack on top of this, why am I different? What's wrong with me mentality? And throughout my early years, I think my initial coping strategy with a lot of that was food, because I just remember, you know, I would get excited about eating certain foods and I would eat, you know, I wouldn't eat any different or much different, I should say, than the people around me. I mean, as kids, it was like we ate cinnamon buns for breakfast, yeah. Pop-Tarts, cereal. I mean, that's
think
just
twice
what you
about
ate.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Pizza, pasta, stuff like that. I just think I probably ate a little bit more maybe than the average kid, because when I was like 10, 11, 12 years old, I started to get a little pudgy and I started to develop some excess body fat to now where I'm wearing like some husky pants. So again, I'm looking at my friends who aren't gaining weight. I am. And I'm like, what the heck, man? Is the world like against me? Like, what's wrong with me? Like, I'm not good at sports. My family is different than other kids' families. I'm gaining weight. Like, I can't enjoy the same things in life that my friends are. Like, am I destined to failure? And then on top of all of that, every kid, every guy at that time, like part of his identity was like, are the cute girls interested in him? And the girls weren't interested in me at all. Like, dude, when I say like they weren't interested in me, I didn't have a girlfriend at all in high school, middle school, elementary school, like nothing, right? And so this all kind of caught up with me to where I had built this immense amount of anxiety, uncertainty, insecurities inside of me that it was just ready to burst the seam whenever it had the opportunity to. And that first real opportunity came to me when my neighbor offered me a hit off a marijuana pipe. And I know, like, now me sharing this and talking about this, it's maybe a bit different than if I were to talk about this, say, 10, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. because now it's fairly accepted and it's legal in many places. But the important takeaway here is I never thought that because of me taking that first hit, that it would eventually lead me to one day becoming incarcerated on felony drug charges. Like, nobody does. Like, if mm-hmm. people knew that that was going to be the automatic result of making a choice like that, I don't think as many people would make that initial choice, or at least they would think long and hard about it before doing so. And when I took that first hit off the marijuana pipe, I felt that bubble like burst. I felt that monkey come off my back to where I could finally be at peace with who I was. I could finally be at peace with the decisions that, you know, I was making at the time, or that whatever I was going to make, could be at peace with the girls not being interested in me. Like, my life just seemed very good all of a sudden because that pain had been subsided. And that led to just massive amounts of self-destruction through other bad habits, addictions, selling drugs that eventually put me behind bars.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. I mean, I could definitely relate to that bubble bursting feeling as a kid. I had like a pretty tumultuous childhood as well. My parents didn't end up getting divorced until I was 16, but probably should have happened a lot earlier with everything that was going on. And I think it's so funny how like kids always turn everything on themselves, right? Like, I would always ask myself those questions too of like, what the hell is wrong with me? What did I do wrong? I'm so confused. Like, why am I so misunderstood? And at the time, obviously, as a kid, like, I didn't have the wherewithal or the emotional intelligence to know, like, hey, man, like, this isn't really about you, or this isn't your problem, or like, this is somebody else's shit. And I just internalized all that for me. And then it was, you know, all these different vices and like negative self-talk in my head of like, we need to find a tentacle to latch onto to something that's going to make us feel better. So like you said that all these guys in elementary school and middle school are like looking for girls to think they were cute, and like that was my superpower. That was what my tentacle like latched onto, that like instantly made me feel this like validation and gratification and self-worth that I wasn't getting from my home life or in the classroom, because I really always struggled and same thing with you. I love sports even to this day. And I had a twin brother who like went through puberty before me. So he was bigger and stronger and faster. He would kick my ass playing one-on-one in the driveway every night. And it just like, it made me feel terrible. And like suddenly these girls that were telling me I was cute, like made me feel good. And then obviously that, you know, you grow older and to high school and drugs and alcohol become involved. And then people get more like sexually adventurous and all these new things. And then you just want to build and you need more and you need more. And then kind of like you said, it like leads us down this path where we end up in a place that we would have said was impossible if you told us that at the first step.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. And I guess, and I can relate to what you just said as well with like the girl situation. And even though I didn't, you know, get the validation maybe that you were able to get through your ability to, you know, get girls, I was doing it for like that reason, I think, at the time of where I wanted to fit in. I wanted to feel cool. I was like, all right, like, even though these girls are not treating me right, I'm going to do what I can to convince them otherwise. And you're right. Like, we don't have the emotional intelligence at that age to be like, yeah, like the way somebody's treating you. Cause I was picked on and bullied a lot in school too, to understand that the way somebody's treating you isn't about you. It's about them. Like, no, like 12-year-old, 13-year-old wants to hear that. Right. And the other thing, you know, specifically with like the girl thing and the external validation and how that can be troublesome as well, is that it's a slippery slope. Because like, you know, if you had told me when I was a teenager, like, what are a few things, Doug, to get you to stop doing what you were doing, if I could just give you these things, like, what would you want? Like, and it's like, what do you want? And I would have said, I want, you know, a nice body. I want big biceps. I want a six pack. I want to date pretty women and I want to make great money. And after I got out of jail and turned my life around, I had those things and I chased them so hard and I became relentless because I thought that based on the way I grew up and all the things I didn't have, that would lead me to happiness. Mm-hmm. And what I found was it didn't. And I was even more miserable because I felt that I was lied to. Like, I lied to myself, I guess, right? In that I was telling myself that as long as you get to this place, you achieve these things, like, life will be a lot easier and taste a lot better. And life tasted even worse because I felt like I had just like wasted so much time, like getting to that point, only to find out that that external validation in chasing these things, even though they were legal and I wasn't going to necessarily get arrested or go to jail for them,
yeah,
it still filled that same void that drug addiction did for me as a kid.
Yeah. Once you started smoking pot in high school, obviously I assume it became, you know, kind of a daily occurrence, if not a regular occurrence. When did you first realize that like that was kind of like a vice for you or like a problem for you in some way? Like, I always think it's so interesting for all of us, like, we call it our first mental health experience, but obviously, yeah, since we don't have that emotional intelligence, I always think it's so cool. Like, when do we become conscious of our mental health even being a thing, or like know that we're feeling anxious or sad or depressed? Or like, do you remember kind of being conscious of your mental health for the first time?
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely many layers to that because, as I said, I would come home from school after being rejected by girls or being picked on, and I would be so upset.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be depressed about like what's going on. And then I'd also be anxious about like, is this going to happen again tomorrow? Or am I going to get rejected at the dance? Like, am I going to find love? Like, all these thoughts would go through my head. And then specifically with like the pot, like, when did I know that, you know, that kind of became a problem? It was hard because I often will say that I think your environment creates a false sense of normalcy because that's just the only reality you know, right? Is what you see and what you experience on a daily basis. And because I had maneuvered my way into this friend group to fit in, and all we did was ride around and get high throughout high school, to me, that was normal because everybody else around me was doing it. So to me, that was all I knew. So the moment that anybody else came in and was like, Doug, you're messing up, you shouldn't be doing this, to me, my reality was a bit warped to where I was able to rationalize and justify it because so many other people around me were doing it. I mean, my first real, I would say, obstacle in this was when I got kicked out of my mom's house and sent to my dad's house on my 16th birthday. And at this point, I had developed a habit of smoking pot every single day. And I'd also like, well, you know, you'd buy like an eighth and sell a couple grams just to be able to like, you know, smoke a little bit for free. And then once you realize that, wow, you can make some money, you can smoke for free, then you start to build off of that. And I was then starting to like sell just like a little bit, I guess, on the side. And it wasn't even about a business thing for me. It was more like about validation that I felt wanted and people were calling me, and I was now the guy who was, you know, selling things that people wanted, and that felt good too. Mm-hmm. And at this time on my 16th birthday, like, you know, not too long before that, I had had a party when my mom was in the hospital. And because, you know, back in high school, I'm sure as you know, like the thing was when parents went out of town, like what you did was you just had a party, you had people over, I guess, as they used to call it. And my parents never really left like that. And so at a time where I was doing everything I possibly could to fit in and be somebody that I thought I wanted to be and be hang around with the cool kids, when my mom was like, yeah, I'm going to have a hysterectomy, I'm going to be out, you know, for X amount of time, I'm like, oh, I'm not, my thoughts aren't, man, like, poor mom, it's like party time, right? That's how warped my mind was. And so I managed to manipulate my way into, you know, convincing her that I think I was either staying somewhere else or whatever, but I convinced her that I wasn't going to be at the house. And I unlocked her, like some window in her basement or something that I just figured would not be checked to see if it was locked, snuck in, had a bunch of kids in a townhouse, and cops come, you know, they find alcohol and everything else that was going on inside of there. And I end up running, thinking, like yeah, I'm going to run. They're never going to catch me. Well, I mean, sure enough, a few hours later, I'm home and facing the music. She finds out. And that was like a big mess up on my end. And also, it put this big wedge between me and her to where she really didn't trust me. So then on my 16th birthday, I was weighing out a little bit of pot for a neighbor, and my brother, who at the time he was like trying to get in on like going to get high with us before I went to get ice cream for my birthday. And I was just like, nah, man, like, I don't want you to do this. But I was like, if you want to watch the door to make sure mom doesn't walk in on me while I'm weighing this out, that'd be great. And so in walks my mom. He didn't really watch. And then she takes the pot, flushes it down the toilet, kicks me out of my house that night to go live with my dad, who my dad and I had a really toxic relationship, I'll say, growing up. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it felt like the biggest rejection ever. And I felt so abandoned. I felt lost. I felt angry. Like every single negative emotion that you could experience was experienced in my heart, in my mind at that time. And I changed high schools within a 24-hour period, basically. And they thought that, all right, whatever's going on right now is not working. So when we're going to take him out of his environment and put him into another environment where he's around different kids, a different type of school and that sort of thing, and maybe he'll get his act together. And it didn't. I mean, because of course now it's created even more pain, more trauma, more what's wrong with me. And I found my way into new friend groups up there to find the people to get high with. And I was so like eager to fit in right away that people thought I was a narc, because I would go and be like, hey, I got weed, nowhere to get weed. And they're like, dude, I think this guy Doug's like a narc. Like, he keeps telling me he's got weed and he's only been here like 2 days, you know?
And it's so funny.
Yeah. And I barely graduated high school because all we would do is ride around and get high. And I just was cutting class all the time.
Yeah.
And then when I graduated high school, I'll say, I think things really took a turn for the worst, where I wasn't going to be just a recreational drug user. I was now at a crossroads where people were going off to college. I wasn't. And I ended up getting hooked up with a drug dealer and started to sell drugs, sell pot to now make money. So now I'm picking up quantities of pot to sell to people. And it wasn't just to sell a little bit on the side and make a little bit of, you know, pocket change. It wasn't just to smoke for free. Now it was like, I'm going to try and make a living doing this. And that void inside of me, to where I wanted to feel wanted, loved, needed, was getting fueled like crazy every single day, because my phone would blow up all the time because I had drugs. And then as you start to escalate in the drug game, if you will, you start to meet people who are doing things other than pot. And I got introduced to cocaine not too long after I graduated high school. And I loved coke because I was a guy who had super low self-esteem, super low self-confidence, and Coke just gave you this insane amount of euphoria when you first do it, to where you feel like you can achieve everything that you possibly could want to do that you didn't think you could do before. But the problem for that in me, because I developed such a habit with Coke now every single day because I wanted to keep chasing that feeling, was I had really bad anxiety. And Coke and anxiety go about as well together as somebody, you know, trying to eat pizza and lose weight every day. It's just not a good recipe. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point, as far as my mental health, where I started to develop like this thing now, it's called panic disorder. But at the time, I was just getting panic attacks, and I didn't know what panic attacks were, because mental health back in, I mean, I guess this has got to be, you know, the mid 2000s or whatever. Like, nobody's talking about mental health like they are today, right? And I remember one night, super high on drugs, and I graduated high school, and I was kicked out of my dad's house, and for months I'd been bouncing around couch to couch to, you know, just survive and live on my friends' couches. And I'd found myself now at this point at a friend's house on his couch, like living there on a more permanent basis, I knew I wasn't going to be there forever, but I had established some quote unquote residence there that I'd been staying there for some time. And I remember coming back to his house, and he had just gone off to college. So it was kind of a transition period where, you know, they kind of let me know, like, listen, you're cool to stay here, but try to like work your way out of here because he's gone. It was kind of awkward for me. And now I'm living at my buddy's house when he's not even there.
Yeah.
And I come home one night, super high. And on my way home, I felt this, my face go numb. My heart started racing, started getting these weird pains, aches, the whole nine yards. I thought I was like dying. I really did. Because I didn't know what a panic attack was at that time. So I was like, man, I mean, I could die. I mean, I've had a few friends, you know, die of drug or alcohol related deaths. At this point, it could happen. I get to my friend's house. I'm like, I'm telling his mom, like, we need to go to the hospital. And she's like, wait, what? I was like, I think I'm dying. She's like, Doug, like, you're like 18 years old or 19, or however old I was. I don't remember exactly how old I was. And she's like, you're not dying. And I'm like, yes, I am. So we go to the hospital. I run to the emergency room. I'm like, help, help, I'm dying. And they're like, sir, like, sit down. Like, you're not dying. And I'm just like, what do you mean? They're like, you're not dying. I'm like, yes, I am. Make a long story short, they end up like hooking me up to like, you know, some sensors and get my vitals and everything. They tell me that I just had a big panic attack.
Yeah.
But now I had developed this phobia that I had just assumed that every time I got high now, whether it was with any type of drug, that I was going to get a panic attack. So what happened? I would get high. I would smoke pot with my friends and I get a panic attack. And I think you'll appreciate this. I remember like going to a local bookstore and buying this book on how to survive like panic attacks. And my friends, every time I would get a panic attack, it's funny you look back at this now, just because nobody talked about it like it's talked about now. My friends would be like, Doug, go get your book, go read your book and figure out like how to calm yourself down.
Yeah.
Because nobody knew what to do. And they'd have to drive my car and it was just a mess. And what really brought me to my knees was my inability to change my environment, my inability to change my friends, because I became addicted to the community and the people I was spending time with.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would think at that point, you would say, all right, Doug, like, I mean, you're not, you know, going to college, even though you really wanted to. You are spending time, you know, doing and selling drugs all day. You just were in the emergency room thinking you were dying from a drug-related death. Like, you have crippling anxiety. Like, maybe it's time to just change your friends, make better choices. But I was so addicted to those people because I had been, you know, kicked out of my parents' house, and I grew up in a home where there wasn't like a tight family unit. Like, yeah. I had clinged on to other people to fill that, even though some of that environment wasn't in my best interest. And then on top of that, I wanted to continue to numb all this emotional pain that I had. And so somebody offered me a 5 milligram Percocet, and it was like unlike anything else. I mean, I felt this immense amount of euphoria and like numbness at the same time, which was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And that in itself became hyper addicting. And on top of that, I noticed that I could be high on painkillers and then get high on pot with my friends and stuff, and I wouldn't have a panic attack. So I was like, I've solved it. Like I can just
that's the fix. Painkiller. Yeah.
That's the fix. And that ended up becoming a horrific thing to where it nearly cost me my life and got to the point where I was doing 300-400 milligrams of Oxycontin up my nose every single day to the point where half my left nostril was missing. And I nearly lost my life because of it. And I think as I look back now, my biggest setback ended up becoming my biggest blessing when I was arrested on Cinco de Mayo 2008. I was riding around with a few of my friends to make a drug deal. And I'm sure as you know, or maybe people listening to this who have experienced any type of addiction, you know that like when you're in the thick of it, like it's like this weird religion to where all you care about is like that. You don't care about anything else other than who you're getting high with, when you're doing it, what you're doing it, what kind of song you're going to listen to, what kind of food you're going to eat afterwards because you can't eat until you've gotten high. And that I had this busted headlight that I should have fixed, you know, long before, but it didn't like fit into that equation of addiction for me. And so I didn't get it fixed, even though people were telling me all the time, like, Doug, fix your busted headlight. You're going to get pulled over. Like you're right. You can't ride dirty with a busted headlight. And there was a cop running radar on the night of Cinco de Mayo 2008. And I decided it was going to be a good idea while I have drugs in the car, scale, money. I decided it'd be a great idea to flash my high beams at this police officer to try to hide the fact that I had a busted headlight. And all it did was it gave him a reason to pull me over. They're like, all right, what's this dude? Like, why is he flashing his high beams at me? Like a cop.
Right.
Pulls me over, hearts in the pit of my stomach. And at that point, I thought my life was over because I was like, man, like I have so much in here and I know he's going to find it all.
Yeah.
And one thing leads to the next. I kind of stumble to get my license registration out. He takes that from me, pulls me out of the car, searches the car, finds everything. And I just remember, he found a half a pound of pot in the trunk, a couple $1,000 in cash in the glove box, and then a scale. And I remember like sitting in the back of this cop car in handcuffs facing felony drug charges. And I was just like, man, like how did I get here? Like everything came to a head for me. Like how did the kid who just wanted to be loved, had the kid who just wanted to fit in, be good at sports, had this kid who just wanted like a healthy, you know, his family to be together, whatever it was. Like how did this kid end up in the back of this cop car? And as I look back, it was my inability to deal with my emotions, my inability to deal with stress, my inability to stand up for myself and really develop my own identity of what I wanted for my life. And ultimately made some choices that, you know, put my life in a worse situation than it could have been had I have taken a different approach. And a couple months after that, I'm 20 years old at this point, a couple months after that in September of 2008, so it's actually coming up on, it'll be 2020, it'll be 14 years, like next Friday, the 30th, September 30th, 2008, I go to court. And they had, at this point, they had charged me with a felony, possession with intent to distribute marijuana. And so I go to court and the judge threw the book at me. He sentenced me to 5 years, suspended everything but 90 days, gave me 5 years probation, 200 hours community service, all kinds of fines and drug classes. But he looked at me, he's like, Doug, you're young. You're 20 years old. He's like, this felony conviction is going to haunt you for the rest of your life. He's like, I'm going to cut you a deal. And I'm like, deal? I'm like, what do you mean? You just told me yourself, I'm going to go to jail. Like, where's the deal? He's like, if you complete everything without messing up, no missed probation appointments, you do your community service, you don't fail drug tests, you do all the stuff that I ask you to do, I'll take the felony conviction off your record and give you a PBJ, probation before judgment, at the end of the 5 years. If you do, you know, all the stuff that I've asked you to do.
Right.
And at that time, it really didn't mean much to me because my hope and myself was in the gutter, obviously. And I had, you know, gone to some funerals at that time for people that I hung out with. And it's also 2008. And I'm like, isn't the world supposed to end in 2012? Like all this stuff was going through my mind that like why I shouldn't even believe that this even matters to me.
Yeah. Like who cares at that point?
Yeah, because I really didn't care. I was high in court. I was going to get high when I left. I mean, I just figured that was my life and that was going to be my life until I was in a casket. And I reported to jail. about a week after my 21st birthday. They had given me a few weeks to kind of gather my belongings and stuff. And I cried the day I went into jail because I didn't want to go in. I cried the day I left because I didn't want to leave. And I think what transpired during my 90-day sentence was one of the most, it was the most magical thing that I think has ever happened in my life. And I had like a slew of like negative emotions, you know, anger, fear, resentment, sadness, all this stuff going into it. And I also had like so much fear behind, you know, as far as like what I thought was going to happen to me in jail, being this guy who would like pick fights with people and then make my friends fight for me. And I'd run in the woods.
Yeah.
You know, the kid who was afraid of fighting. I was not in shape. I was scared. So I was like a recipe for somebody to get messed with in jail. And then on top of that, I had this horrific opiate detox to kick cold turkey when I got in there. So I had to get through that for the first few weeks. You can tell me to stop at any time if you want to like ask me something.
Yeah, no, I'm locked in, man.
Cool. So I had to get through that through my first few weeks to where it was like having like detoxing off opiates was like having like the worst case of the flu. It was like uncontrollable bowel movements, vomiting, shakes, pain, you know, all kinds of emotions. And it was tough. But I think the toughest part back then was that I had this feeling that like there was something trying to escape my body. Like I was just either so anxious or whatever the detox was doing to me that I felt like I felt like I was trying to crawl out of my own skin. It was so bizarre.
Mm.
And as I look back, I think it was the old me like trying to leave my body so that the new me could become whole. And my soon-to-be cellmate was sitting there playing Scrabble, and he looked like a more jacked version of Brad Pitt from Fight Club. And he was looking at me, and he was like, "Yo, you're gonna start working out with me when you get through your detox." I was like, "Dude, no way!" Like, have you seen me? Like, I could have been a model for Pillsbury at the time. Like, there's no way I'm going to work out with you. And he was just like, all right, man. Because he could just tell by looking at me that my shoulders are rounded forward. I spoke very softly. I was unconfident. He could just tell I needed to do something to change.
Yeah.
And shortly after that, I see him work out. He's doing thousands of push-ups, hundreds of pull-ups. He's running all over the common area of the jail. And I'm like, dude, this guy is insane. Like, he's super fit. And a couple days later, we're having this conversation in the cell, and he's asking me like, why am I there? And this conversation changed my life. He's like, can I cuss on here?
Yeah.
Okay. So he asked me like, why are you here? He's like, what got you here? And I'm telling him, I'm like, oh, my parents got divorced and kids picked on me and girls rejected me, like all these things. And he looked at me and he was like, quit being a bitch. And I was just like, huh? He was like, dude, you're blaming everybody for your problems but yourself.
Yeah.
He was like, there's plenty of people that were in situations like yours that aren't in jail, right, Doug? He's like, you have two choices. You can be a man, take responsibility for your life, look yourself in the mirror and say, you chose to get yourself in this situation and it's on you to get yourself out. Like, no one's coming to save you. He's like, or you can be a bitch, go cry in the corner, say, woe is me, and blame everybody else for your problems. He's like, most people will do that. And I think I was, at that time, I just was like, man, I think I was at a place, I should say, where I was just ready to learn a little bit, because I had started, the drugs had started to come out of my system. I mean, I had started to feel a bit better about myself. I started to feel a bit better as far as like my ability to think. And I was like, man, I've had 21 jobs until this point in my life. I'm a convicted felon. I'm a drug addict. I have damaged relationships. I can't trust myself, can't trust other people. They don't trust me. Like, clearly, I don't know what I'm doing. So I might as well just try this other thing, which is taking some responsibility and even in trying to work out. And, you know, I got through my detox. And then as soon as I got through everything, I gave exercise a try. And it was one of the most humiliating things I've ever done.
Yeah.
Because I was the kid who had never formally exercised and wasn't, like I said, wasn't good at sports. And now I'm in front of a bunch of grown men facing one of my biggest fears, which was what other people thought of me. And, you know, not being judged. And, you know, because I'd spent my whole life doing whatever I could to make sure that nobody kind of judged me and that people thought of me in this certain way so that I could fit in with the crowd, that I behaved in ways that were just, is, you know, obviously, as I look back, so misaligned with who I was at my core. And I was always humiliated on what people were going to think of me when I made any kind of decision, you know, other than, you know, the decisions I was making to fit in with that crowd that I had become so accustomed to spending time with, that like if I had made any decision other than that, I felt like, man, I'm going to be hyper judged by anybody. And so I get down and do a push up in front of all these guys and collapse. And I'm like saying to my cellmate, I'm like, why can't I do a push up? He's like, 'cause you're fat. And I hated that word, man, 'cause I've been called that like a good bit of my life. And I was just like, what do you mean? He's like, dude, I'm not going to sugarcoat it.
Right.
He was like, you have excess body fat, you don't have upper body strength, you're out of shape, you know, you need all this to be able to hold yourself up, and you can't, and so you're going to collapse. So I tried one for my knees, couldn't do one for my knees, barely could walk up and down the steps because I was smoking a pack to a pack and a half of cigarettes a day and just had no endurance whatsoever. And he agreed to train me in there every single day during my 90-day sentence, and we set some goals to be able to run a mile and to be able to do a set of 10 push-ups by the time I left my sentence. Now, keep in mind, like this, I think this is an important lesson too, that anybody who's struggling to get through anything back then, that seemed like climbing Mount Everest to me.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't do a push up from my knees, could barely walk up and down the steps. So being able to now say, I'm going to run a mile and do 10 push ups, I'm like, wait, what? But the way he taught me to exercise and set goals was something that has helped me so much. And that is like incremental progress, like small steps, small wins lead to bigger, achievements and bigger wins.
Totally. Just how you were saying, we were talking about earlier on the back end of like how the dark road can lead you to a place you never thought that you could get. That's also possible on the other side in terms of recovery and growth, is like we can climb that mountain that we think we can't get to on the other side also. So I think it like mostly people only think about it in the negative perspective.
Right. And I think the thing that I just invite people to do is just, you never know unless you try.
Yeah.
And just give it your all for whatever that thing was and just see where that takes you. You know, because I could have, every part of me thought I was going to fail for the most part, right? And I also could have just sat in the cell and been like, you know what, like, I'm just going to be a victim and blame everybody else for my problems and I'm not even going to try this, like, screw the world. And, you know, being able to, you know, do a push-up from my knees was like the biggest win for me. Because yeah. It's like, holy crap, I never thought I could do this. Now I can. Like, what's next? Let me try two. Let me try three. And then I'm working my way up to doing sets of push-ups from my knees. And then I'm working my way up to doing like a push-up from my feet. And then I was like, holy crap, like I can do a push-up. Like what's next? Two push-ups. And then you start to work your way up this self-confidence ladder and you start to become like bulletproof in a way, to where you understand that the only way for you to build self-confidence is to face your fears, is to do things that you not only know you should, but do things that are uncomfortable for you, obviously that are safe. You know, I'm not talking about like doing anything that's going to jeopardize like your safety. I'm talking about just stuff that, you know you should do, but feels a little bit uncomfortable for you to do.
Yeah.
Because I think
vulnerability.
The fear of the outcome often becomes greater than the fear in itself. And the same thing applied to me when I was running, because, you know, I was so out of shape that it started with me like walking around the common area, and like I would listen to, like, there was no music in there, so you'd have to like, I'd have to like listen to all the music in my head that I had played like when I was riding around, you know, doing and selling drugs. And at the time I was like replaying all my favorite rap songs, because that's right. What I like would listen to, you know. Yeah. That was my choice of music. Then and now I still listen to a fair amount of rap music. And when I was, you know, walking, I would take like a deck of cards, and every time I would take a lap, I would pass a card from my left hand to my right hand so I could track how far I was walking. And then, you know, if I passed like seven cards one night, I'd be like, all right, I did seven laps. And then I would build off of that to the point where now I'm like passing a card each time I ran a lap, and so on and so forth. And I felt like I was finally ready to transform my life after I had been able to achieve those goals. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, what the push-ups or sit-ups or the running did. It wasn't necessarily like that to what translated into me wanting to change. It was what they did for me. It was my ability to get comfortable being uncomfortable, developing some self-discipline, doing things when I didn't even want to do them. There were days I didn't want to exercise. There were days where I didn't want to, you know, run or walk or whatever I was doing that day. but I did it anyway because I knew I would feel better about myself after doing it. And I had to also change the way I talk to myself. You know, I had to really develop my self-confidence and my belief system because I thought of myself as a failure and as a loser up until that point. And I had to really like practice. I mean, I had a lot of time on my hands, so I could practice changing the way I talked to myself when I was in jail. And the day I left, I cried because I not only felt this incredible transformation on so many levels happen inside of the detention center, I also had this guy who like chose to save my life before saving his own, who kind of came in and helped me along so much so that I was like, man, how can I ever repay you?
Yeah.
And he said, pay it forward and don't mess up.
Mm. Have you kept in touch with him or no?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of bitter. I mean, it's kind of sad because I had kept in touch with him. He gave me a workout plan that I still have framed in my place today. So I never forget where I came from.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Got out. Lost a bunch of weight. And then, you know, him and I, we'd exchanged some letters and then he had ended up getting out. We ended up meeting up a few times and doing some workouts together, which was cool.
Wow.
And then, you know, over the course of the time since, you know, we were in and out of touch and I've been trying to get a hold of him for some time because I wanted to actually get him on my own podcast. Cause I was like, man, like Dude, I hear
you have to get him on the show.
Well, the thing is he passed away a few months ago.
Oh man. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I mean, trust me, I wanted to get him on and
yeah.
When I got the news, I was heartbroken. But there's the silver lining in that came from doing stuff like this because, you know, shortly after, or I guess it was like right after he passed, his mom, you know, had messaged me and found me through Facebook and was like, you know, he talks so much about you. I know about like,
that's amazing.
You know, how he helped you and blah, blah, blah. And so she reaches out to me and I find out. And then I'm getting like, I forget who it was, somebody else in his family. I don't know if it was his cousin, his aunt, somebody like reached out to me and were like, oh my God, like I'm listening to you on, I found you somehow on Facebook and I saw you were on like podcasts and I'm listening to you talk about like Eric's story on a podcast and how he helped you. And so now they're like thanking me because they are seeing this guy that they knew at one point before, you know, he had gone down this path and they're hearing these positive things about him, this positive side of him that they had remembered about him.
Yeah.
And they were like thanking me for sharing the story. And I never thought in a million years, like, yes, I get on shows like this and tell my story to help people. But I never thought that I would, you know, never crossed my mind that, yeah, his family is going to be listening to this when he passes away.
Yeah. And like keeping the positive memories of like his legacy alive for them in that way.
Yeah. And I was able to go and speak at his funeral and tell the story. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do because, you know, one of the things I often wondered, and I kind of hinted at this a few minutes ago, was like, why me? Like, why did he just decide to help me? And like, why didn't he put that effort into helping himself? I never understood that. But I think a lot of times in life, our self-confidence and self-esteem is so low that we have lost the ability to believe that we can actually change ourselves and that we still have that goodness and solid nature or solid nature inside of us that we're like, I at least want to try and help somebody else because I do have all this wisdom that I can share. And that becomes, it takes the place in a way of like trying to save yourself as you put all that energy into somebody else. And
totally. And it's so much easier, at least for me, of like, I'm so good at giving advice. I'm terrible at taking my own advice. Like even like codependency is such a huge thing in our society too, of like, it's so much easier for us to focus on somebody else's problem or what they're going through than have to turn that sort of mirror towards ourselves. But I think a few things really stood out to me in particular from your story. And thank you so much for sharing that. I didn't want to like interrupt you at all, cause I was just enjoying it and I was
along you're good.
For the ride and was really just taking it in. I mean, it's a lot. And like I said at the top, there's so much that I relate to, but I think a few things are, one is like, I thought of that scene in Good Will Hunting, like where he tells Matt Damon that like, it's not his fault. Right. And so much of what that show or so much of what this show is like, we need to have these conversations so kids and people can just have the awareness and the education of like what these things are so that we can talk about them. And that when we become parents and have kids, we can talk to our kids about them. And like, we can create these safety nets and these lines of conversation and relationships where we talk about anxiety. Kids know what that is. So when you do feel anxious, you don't feel like you're dying and have to go to the hospital because you know what it means and you have some coping tools in place and things like that, that you can deal with it. So I think that I'm the same way of like, I always blamed myself for everything. And I had to just realize that, I'm just a product of my environment. And like we, like you said in the beginning, like we do the best with what we have. And like, we really just have to learn. There's so much in life that's out of our control. And I read something this morning that I was thinking of too, while you were talking, was like, what role do you play in your suffering? And I had been thinking about that all day. And I was like, damn, that's like really heavy and spot on too. Cause with all this shit, we're always like, well, this, the cop pulled me over and my friend who was in the car, if he hadn't have done this, then I wouldn't have done this. And like all of that stuff. And I'm just like, wow, I really want to be more accountable for my own life and my own decisions and like the roles that I play in all of this stuff. And then the third thing was like just the support system and like how important that has been for me now and like how important that is for everyone. It's like we have to be surrounding ourselves with people who can hold us accountable and who have our best interest at heart. And obviously those are the people who really care about us the most and are going to call us out on our bullshit and who, when they see us like starting to slip a little bit, are going to at least bring it up, right? Obviously no one can change us or fix us or make us not want to use or this or that, but at least having those people that can give you those hard truths and at least put something in front of you. And then it's up to us of whether we're going to take that or not. But yeah, man, that's just, that's kind of what your story brought up for me.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. And like the one thing I wanted to say in response to like one of your points is like you talked about like, you know, that letting people know that it's not necessarily, like, it's not all like their fault. You know what I mean? Like they don't cause all this stuff. And I think, you know, part of my core message is not being a victim and to take full responsibility. And I think there's a line with that.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the line is, you have to understand that, yes, like a lot of what happens to you is definitely not your fault. And people, you know, do things that are terrible and they treat you wrong. The world can be very unfair sometimes. And a lot of what you're experiencing is not your fault. But I guess with that said, like the only way to get yourself out of this hole that life can kind of, you know, pull you down in sometimes, the only way is to like take responsibility and ownership for where you're at in that moment.
Totally.
Acknowledge like where you could have done better and then move forward and say, okay, like, what am I going to do about it? Because you can't change the past. You can't. You can only learn from it. And you sometimes can't change your circumstances. Like there's a lot, I mean, that couldn't have been changed over the last few years, right? Like we saw that perfectly. The only thing that I think we can do is do the best that we can to learn by listening to podcasts like this, like trying to, you know, reach out and ask for help, having a good support system like you hinted at. I'm going to therapy, you know, that was something that's helped me.
Totally.
Movement, I think, is something that I think should be a staple in everyone's life. And not necessarily, you don't have to go to the gym for 2 hours a day, but I mean, even if you're, you know, taking 20 minutes a day to go for a walk and just gather your thoughts, I mean, I think that's a big win.
Yeah. I want to ask you about like change. Obviously, you made a huge change in your life. And I think that one of the biggest things that I've struggled with is like maintaining that change. I think when I hit my rock bottom, you know, was blessed with the gift of desperation and really cleaned up my act a lot and was feeling so motivated and was in it. And I was going to meetings and all this stuff. And then obviously, you know, that kind of tails off as I feel less desperate or life feels more manageable. Did you kind of struggle with that too? Or was it like once you got back into the real world, like you really just kind of flipped that switch? Like how have you been able to maintain that change in your life?
It's a daily journey. You know, and it's not, I don't want to say it's like, you know, as hard now, specifically with the addiction side. I mean, I don't have like cravings or anything like that now, like I did, you know, when I first got out of jail, but life still happens, right? I think, you know, so many times people think that once they get into recovery, they make some change for the better, that all of a sudden, like you're going to be happy the rest of your life and things are just going to be easy. And as a matter of fact, like a lot of that is untrue.
Yeah.
To where now you have to deal with the stuff that maybe you had been suppressing for so long. You got to face the music, if you will. And also you have to practice dealing with things when they get hard, when they get challenging. because, you know, sometimes in recovery, it feels really good when we first make that choice to get into recovery. You're like, man, I'm going to change my life. I'm so excited. I'm finally doing this. And then like you go through a breakup or, you know, you don't get the job or somebody accuses you of like being high or somebody questions something about you or you hear something about you gossiping about you. Then you're now faced with a choice where you're like, all right, like I thought my life was going to be better. Like I thought it was going to be a lot easier. You know, what is all this stuff? Why is this happening to me? And you have an opportunity to say, all right, like this is what it's about. How am I going to respond differently than I did in my past with, you know, using addictions to self-medicate, or am I going to use this as an opportunity to grow and develop some new coping strategies and mechanisms to deal with stress and uncertainty? And I think the other thing I often tell people is you got to look at the big picture. I think so many times we look at life in this small lens, and it's because so much of what we deal with now is so instant, right? And it's in front of our faces constantly, that we don't look at the bigger picture and look at how far we've come, not how far we have to go. You know, it's easy to pay attention to all the stuff that you haven't accomplished or money you haven't made or, you know, relationships you haven't healed, or I can go on and on. But what's challenging in this world of more, more, more comparison is to just sit back for a minute and be like, man, like I've done a good job. I'm doing the best I can. Or man, like I'm so proud of myself for doing X, Y, or Z. And just knowing that, you know, this is going to be a journey and it's not always going to be easy. There's going to be times in life where it throws you curveballs and things are unexpected. And there's going to be days where you feel like crap about yourself. And that's okay too. And I think the more we can just reduce the stigma around that and just know that that's just part of life, is that there's going to be these peaks and valleys and ups and downs, I think the more receptive people will be to acknowledging that not only as part of their life, but taking the proper steps to know that, you know, they're not a piece of crap and they're not a failure because they're feeling that way, and they'll actually make the right decision to move forward.
Yeah, dude. I mean, what you just said is basically what Mad Happy means, like truly. And that really is the perspective that we're trying to give everyone, is that we will have those valleys and that suffering and struggling is just a part of life. And, you know, like the name of your show, like that can be an advantage, and that can be a huge thing that we can learn from about ourselves and about the world, so that when we do kind of make our way out of that valley or start to go up to that peak, we have this newfound perspective and like takeaways of who we are, why we are, what we want, and all these things. So yeah, man, you hit it right on the head with that one.
Thanks, man. I mean, that's true though, because I think we get so caught up, man, in like, you know, what we haven't achieved, and that life's supposed to be perfect all the time, and it's supposed to be this constant highlight reel of, you know, happiness and success and money and all this stuff, and that's just, it's not reality. And I think that people just need to understand that, you know, reaching a goal, changing your life, you know, optimizing your health, it sucks. It takes a lot of hard work. It takes dedication, it takes discipline, it takes biting your tongue sometimes. It takes saying no to certain things. It takes, you know, cutting certain people out of your life. It takes, you know, getting up a little earlier or whatever it is. Like that is all a challenge, and that can be hard. But not reaching that goal and quitting on yourself is hard too, just in a different way. It's more of a long-term hard, because now you're teaching yourself that you shouldn't believe in yourself. You're teaching yourself that every time life gets hard, that means you should just quit. It's you're teaching yourself that you're not worthy of going forward and achieving these things when life gets hard. And I think the last thing I'll say on that is I think part of it is just keeping yourself in the game. Because as a trainer, I'll see this a lot. The scale is a metric that, you know, most people use. I don't like always using it, obviously, for a variety of reasons, but obviously it's a metric that's will probably be used for forever, if not quite a long time, as far as like, you know, health is concerned and people's goals. And it's an easy analogy to use as far as like when things aren't working, as far as like, and this applies to recovery, this applies to everything, in that people get super excited about when they want to lose weight, right? They hire a trainer, they go to the gym, and things are going really good. They're eating better. They're working out. They're making new friends at the gym, and things are awesome. And then all of a sudden, the scale stops moving. And they're like, well, what happened? Like, I was losing like 3 pounds a week. I was losing 5 pounds a week. It's not getting anywhere. 3 days go by. Scale's still not moving. Maybe you gain like a half a pound. Now you're really panicking. You're like, oh, crap. And what happens a lot, man, in that situation is people just quit. And they say, you know what? Like, it's not worth it. This is too hard. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, it's never going to happen. They just quit. And the perspective I always give people, whether they're friends of mine that are asking me for advice on this stuff, people I'm coaching, clients, is there's really two options. You can quit and just completely discount yourself at all, like from achieving the goal you want. Or you could take a step back and say, okay, like I'm still in the game. I'm not giving up on myself. What can I control? Well, maybe I can see, you know, how many calories I'm really taking in on a daily basis. Maybe I can start to track that a little bit more. Maybe I can really be hyper-focused on my sleep, my water. Maybe I can make sure that I'm actually getting the steps that I'm telling myself or putting the steps that I'm saying I'm getting in my fitness tracker or whatever. And then like go from there and just have this whatever it takes mentality to achieve whatever it is. And I think that's just a perfect example there of, if anybody is listening to this and they hit any kind of roadblock or plateau in whatever journey they're on, to just remember that there's going to be some weeks that the scale doesn't move. There's going to be some weeks where you don't feel good. There's going to be some weeks where, you know, your mental health is worse than it was the week before, and that's okay. I just think what's not okay, and I'm not even saying this in a judgy way, I'm just saying this in a I've been there way, that you're not going to feel good about yourself long term is giving up on yourself. And you just got to keep you got to keep yourself in the game, control the controllables, and just be hyper focused about being relentless about becoming a better version of yourself through that process.
100%. And it's about how we talk to ourselves in those moments of like, if I'm having a bad day, it doesn't mean that I'm a bad person. And if I'm feeling sad, I'm not sad all the time. I'm just sad right now. And let's see how I feel in the morning, or let's see how I feel in an hour. It's like all about how we talk to ourselves and like the beliefs that we have about ourselves. And, you know, if you convince yourself that you can do something, like you can fucking do it. Like, it's only when you're kind of telling yourself that you're not going to make it, or you're in this kind of like negative like thought loop and all those things, like that will just drag you down further and further. And like, that's why we always try to choose to talk about mental health like through this lens of optimism and like really the power of positivity in that way. Cause if we kind of lead with that, then even though we're only controlling the controllables and there are all those other things, it's like our mindset and the way that we choose to approach life and talk to ourselves and think about ourselves, if we can put the positive spin on that, like it can do wonders for us.
Absolutely. I mean, you nailed it right there, because it's like, I'm convinced that our thoughts really do control our actions, you know, because it's like, you got to think about it, you know, in this way, in that if you are convinced that whatever you're going to achieve is not going to work, well, what's that going to do to your behavior and your actions? You're not going to try as hard, because you're going to be like, well, I'm not going to make it anyway. So what's the point of putting in all this effort? Because I'm already convinced myself that I'm not going to make it, so that if I put in the effort, I'm going to be wasting my time. Or you just, you know, do what a lot of people unfortunately do, and they just completely don't try at all. And I had to battle this with girls. It's fun. It's funny. And I was afraid of asking a girl out like in public for years. Like, I'm into my 20s, like, to where I was mortified, because my fear of the outcome was greater than the actual fear itself. Like, I thought that I would go up to a girl in a store and I would start talking to her about like broccoli or green, whatever, you know, the old grocery store pickup lines or whatever. And that, like, I would ask for this girl's number. I would tell her I was interested. And then if she said no, that meant that every single other girl was never going to be interested in me.
Right.
But, you know, as I've aged and as I've practiced that more, and as I've, you know, had, you know, some luck with girls, you realize that, you know, there's other people out there. And I think that the important lesson, anything like this too, is like, Would you rather be rejected by somebody else because you believed in yourself enough to like ask for that opportunity? Or would you rather reject yourself for not believing in yourself?
Yeah.
You know, and you got to put yourself out there. And like, I think whether it's business, relationships, recovery, any kind of personal endeavor, it just takes this level of vulnerability and knowing that there's gonna be times where you slip and fall, and that's okay. I mean, confidence isn't built, and the way you and your self esteem isn't built, you know, when you get to the top. I mean, I think true confidence is built like on the way up. After, you know, every time you fall, you continue to get back up and believe in yourself, even during moments where you shouldn't. Like that's what happened with me in jail. It wasn't like I had a lot of confidence in myself, I guess, you know, when I did the 10 pushups, but my biggest increases in self-confidence came from me being able to do two pushups and starting to stack all these wins to rebuild my self-confidence and self-esteem.
100%. My last question for you, just about the future. What are some goals you have, or what do you kind of want to do with the show or your story? Obviously you've touched so many people and have been a huge inspiration. How do you think about continuing to spread that?
Appreciate you asking that. I mean, I think right now what I've been doing a lot of, obviously with the show, is just bringing on different thought leaders, people from all walks of life to share their stories and share different types of adversity they've been through and how they've gotten through it. And then also subject matter experts on different subjects of adversity, whether it be mental health. You know, we talk about neuroscience, we talk about relationships, psychology, health, wellness, to get like, you know, some top tier advice on those subjects. So that's with the podcast. And obviously I want to continue to grow that. I mean, I've been speaking, I guess I spoke a few times in the last month, and I've really been enjoying like that, like putting myself out there more to be able to share my story to help other people and inspire people. And especially like kids, you know, that's the audience I hope to reach with sharing my story, because there's a lot of kids that are just struggling right now. And on top of that, like a part of my business is my training business. I train people in recovery. I train, you know, a lot of times I'll get like, you know, young adults who come to me who are struggling with addiction, mental health, and I train them and I coach them. And, you know, the hope is that's a catalyst for them to change the rest of their life, just kind of like it helped change mine when I was in jail.
Nice. Well, yeah, we'll definitely link your show and everything in the notes. And again, really appreciate just the conversation and your advocacy. And we definitely share the same passion for mental health, and especially reaching the younger generation too, and just kind of providing them with that knowledge that it's okay and that we all go through this stuff together. So thanks again, Doug.
Dude, thanks for having me on. This has been a great conversation.
Of course. Peace, brother. Thank you guys so much for listening to the episode. Last one for September. Happy fall, everybody. I hope you have a beautiful, beautiful weekend. And just another reminder about the Local Optimist Digest. It is our mental health newsletter that we release every week on Instagram on Tuesday, on email on Thursday. You can subscribe on the Local Optimist page when we post it. It's really, really cool. I know that I look forward to reading it every single week. It's really just a roundup of mental health in the news from all around the world, be it in education, in pop culture, in politics. You know, mental health is becoming more and more prevalent in our society every single day. And this is really, you know, the best place to just get all that news together in one spot every week. So be sure to check out the Local Optimist Digest if you haven't. And if you already do subscribe, thank you for being a mental health advocate and ally and supporter. And we will see you guys next week. Thanks so much. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.